Chapter 66. Colonel General Viktor Kolchak, chief of the 15,000 Soviet military forces and advisors based on Cuban soil, came from behind his desk and embraced Velikov warmly. "General, you don't know how glad I am to see you alive."
"The feeling is mutual, Colonel General," said Velikov, returning Kolchak's bear hug.
"Sit down, sit down. We have much to discuss. Whoever was behind the destruction of our island surveillance facility will pay. A communication from President Antonov assures me he will not take this outrage sitting down."
"No one agrees more than me," said Velikov. "But we have another urgent matter to discuss. Care for a glass of vodka?"
"I can do without," Velikov replied brusquely. "Rum and cola takes place tomorrow morning at 10:30. Are your preparations complete?" Kolchak poured a small shot of vodka for himself. "Soviet officials and our Cuban friends are discreetly slipping out of the city in small groups. Most of my military forces have already left to begin sham maneuvers 40 miles away. By dawn, all personnel, equipment, and important documents will have been quietly evacuated."
"Leave some behind," Velikov said casually.
Kolchak peered over his rimless glasses like a grandmother hearing a four-letter word from a child.
"Leave what behind, General?"
Velikov brushed off the derisive look. 50 Soviet civilian personnel, wives and families, and 200 of your military forces."
"Do you know what you're asking?"
"Precisely. We cannot lay blame on the CIA for 100,000 deaths without suffering casualties ourselves. Russians dying beside Cubans. We'll reap propaganda rewards that will go far in smoothing the path for our new government."
"I can't bring myself to throw away the lives of 250 countrymen."
"Conscience never bothered your father when he cleared German minefields by marching his men over them."
"Well, that was war."
"Only the enemy has changed," Velikov said coldly. "We have been at war with the United States since 1945. The cost in lives is small compared to increasing our hold in the Western Hemisphere."
"There is no room for argument, General. You will be expected to do your duty."
"I don't need the KGB lecturing me on my duty to the motherland," Kolchak said without rancor. Velikov shrugged indifferently.
"We all do our part.
Getting back to rum and cola. After the explosion, your troops will return to the city and assist in medical and relief operations. My people will oversee the orderly transition of government. I'll also arrange for international press coverage showing benevolent Soviet soldiers caring for the injured survivors."
"As a soldier, I have to say I find this entire operation abhorrent. I can't believe Comrade Antonov is a party to it."
"His reasons are valid, and I, for one, do not question them."
Kolchak leaned against the edge of his desk, his shoulders sagging.
"I'll have a list made up of those who will stay."
"Thank you, Colonel General."
"I assume all preparations are complete?"
Velikov nodded.
"You and I will accompany the Castro brothers to the parade reviewing stand. I will be carrying a pocket transmitter that will detonate the explosives in the primary ship. When Castro begins his usual marathon speech, we will make an unobtrusive exit to a waiting staff car. Once we are safely out of range, allowing about 30 minutes to drive 15 miles, I'll activate the signal and the blast will follow."
"How do we explain our miraculous escape?" Kolchak asked sarcastically.
"First reports will have us dead and missing. Later, we'll be discovered among the injured."
"How badly injured?"
"Just enough to look convincing. Torn uniforms, a little blood, and some artificial wounds covered by bandages.
Like two hooligans who vandalized the dressing rooms of a theater."
"Hardly the metaphor that comes to mind."
Kolchak turned and sadly looked out the window of his headquarters over the busy city of Havana.
"Impossible to believe that tomorrow at this time," he said in a morbid tone, "all this will be a smoldering, twisted sea of misery and death."
The president worked at his desk late. Nothing was cut and dried, black or white. The job of chief executive was one compromise after another. His wins over Congress were diluted by tacked-on amendments. his foreign policies picked apart by world leaders until little remained of the original proposals. Now he was trying to save the life of a man who had viewed the United States as his number one enemy for 30 years. He wondered what difference any of it would make 200 years from now. Dan Fawcett walked in with a pot of coffee and sandwiches. "The Oval Office never sleeps," he said with forced cheerfulness. "Your favorite, tuna with bacon." He offered the president a plate and then poured the coffee. "Can I help you with anything?" "No, thanks, Dan. Just editing my speech for tomorrow's news conference. I can't wait to see the faces of the press corps when you lay the existence of the moon colony on them and then introduce Steinmetz and his people. I previewed some of the videotapes they brought back of their lunar experiments. They're incredible." The president set the sandwich aside and thoughtfully sipped the coffee. "The world is upside down." Fawcett paused in mid-bite. "Pardon?" "Think of the terrible incongruity. I'll be informing the world of man's greatest modern achievement at the same time that Havana is being blown off the map." "Any late word from Brogan since Pitt and Jesse LeBaron popped up at our special interest section?" "Not in the past hour. He's keeping a vigil at his office, too." "How in the world did they ever manage it?" 200 miles through a hostile nation. Beats me." The direct phone line to Langley rang. "Yes?"
"Martin Brogan, Mr. President. Havana reports that searchers have not yet detected a positive radioactive reading in any of the ships."
"Did they get on board?"
"Negative. Security is too heavy. They can only drive by the two ships tied to the docks. The other one, an oil tanker, is moored in the bay. They circled it in a small boat."
"What are you telling me, Martin? The bomb was unloaded and hidden in the city?"
"The ships have been under tight surveillance since arriving in the harbor. No cargo has come off."
"Maybe the radiation can't leak through the steel hulls of the ships."
"The experts at Los Alamos assure me it can. The problem is our people in Havana are not professional radiation experts. They're also hamstrung having to use commercial Geiger counters that aren't sensitive enough to measure a light reading."
"Why didn't we get qualified experts with the right equipment in there?" the president demanded.
"It's one thing to send in one man on a diplomatic mission with a small suitcase like your friend Hagen. It's something else to smuggle a team with 500 pounds of electronic equipment. If we had more time, something might have been arranged. Covert boat landings and parachute drops stand little chance through Cuba's defense screen. Smuggling by ship is the best method, but we're talking at least a month's preparation."
"You make it sound like we're a guy with an unknown disease and no known cure."
"That about sums it up, Mr. President," said Brogan. "About all we can do is sit and wait and watch it happen."
"No, I won't have that. In the name of humanity, we have to do something. We can't let all those people die."
He paused, feeling a knot growing in his stomach.
"God, I can't believe the Russians will actually set off a nuclear bomb in a city. Doesn't Antonov realize he's plunging us deeper into a morass there can be no backing out of?"
"Believe me, Mr. President, our analysts have run every conceivable contingency through the computers. There is no easy answer. Asking the Cubans to evacuate the city through our radio networks will accomplish nothing. They'll simply ignore any warnings coming from us."
"There is still hope Ira Hagen can get to Castro in time."
"Do you really think Fidel will take Hagen at face value?"
"Not very likely.
He'll think it's only a plot to discredit him."
"I'm sorry, Mr. President. We have to steel ourselves against the disaster, because there isn't a damn thing we can do about it."
The president wasn't listening anymore. His face reflected grim despair. "We put a colony on the moon," he thought, "and yet the world's inhabitants still insist on murdering each other for asinine reasons. I'm calling a cabinet meeting tomorrow early, before the moon colony announcement," he said in a defeated voice. "We'll have to create a plan to counter Soviet and Cuban accusations of guilt and pick up the pieces as best we can."